And that's for all you aspiring writers. You don't have to know what you're doing. Just succumb to the mystery.
Well, you've got to trust the writing. Yeah, that's the thing. You really do have to trust the writing.
Yeah. If I've got you right, the analogy when you talk about writing a novel is like patchwork. So you do... Is that an appropriate analogy? You're doing different moments or different colours or shades and then you're putting them together.
Well, what I kind of think of, it's like cheating by having this blank book and opening it at random like that and say, oh, I can see, I've got page 102. And now I've got page... 36. It's as if you were somehow seeing that, because these are actual moments from the book that's going to be finished. Right. For example, I know an imaginary life, which is in some ways the most mysterious of all the books that I've ever written, I mean to myself, is that I was walking, I lived at Cremorne Point in those days, and I was walking up to the shops up in Spofforth Street, quite a little walk through kind of jungly part of Sydney, and I came back, and I did what I frequently do. I mean, I frequently write when I'm walking. Mm-hmm. And the other time, which is really good, I frequently write when I'm ironing. And they're both really, really useful, because it's got something to do with the body, it's repeated motions or something, and that puts me into a kind of trance, which is very, very good for writing. And I was walking up and back from Spofforth Street, and when I came back, I'd written a whole lot of stuff, which I immediately wrote down. And what it was, if you know. An imaginary life. It's the stuff about Ovid seeing the poppy in an imaginary life, which in some ways is kind of one of the most striking moments in the book. And I wrote it all down, and I didn't know what it was. I didn't know whether it was a kind of draft of a poem or what it was, and I simply left it. And then about 2 weeks later, I came home, because it was the end of the year, and I had the first of my 1,000 HSC papers to correct, a batch of about 100, and there was a letter from an agent, and it said, I've been talking to Patrick White, and he tells me you've written a book about Ovid in Australia. And I burst out laughing, because there was no such book. And then he said, could I see it? There was no such book. And suddenly it clicked that what I had written was about Ovid. And I then sat down that night and wrote 5,000 words of that book. And not the beginning, but beginning with the stuff about the poppy. And after that, I mean, the book just came like that. Mm. So that was an absolute stroke of luck. I mean, the book came into existence and turned out to be a novel. I didn't even know it was a novel. Yeah. I mean, I'd finished the book before I realised I'd written a novel. I thought it was a monologue or a long prose poem or whatever. And I had been doubly fortunate, because I had done the most difficult thing in any writer's life, which is novelist life, which is to write your second novel without realising that you're doing it. Because the second novel is a terrible problem, whatever happens. So I kind of skipped that. And that novel was written, I recently discovered a diary in which we worked out that novel was written on 21 days across 6 weeks, in which I also marked 1,000 HSC papers and 600 first-year poetry papers. It's a strange thing. So there are no rules about it, no rules at all. And it's great to discover so early in your writing career, as it was for me, that there are no rules.
Interesting listening to you saying that. It sounds, for you, the writer, as though fixed genre don't matter. They matter to the publishers and the marketing people. They have to give it a name, don't they?
And they matter to the academics.
Right.
No, I still don't. You know, you could well say that that's not a novel or a novella. It's a long prose poem, or it's a monologue. Mm.
Well, it's certainly quite unlike anything we'd seen, I think, in the Australian literary culture when it came out in 78.
Well, I realised, and that was the other strange thing with the book, was that I realised it was completely unpublishable because you couldn't publish a book in Australia that didn't have an Australian subject.
Mm.
And I just put it away in a drawer, and then quite by accident, it's too long a story to tell, but quite by accident, the wife of a visiting American poet who was here said to me, "I believe you've written a novel." And we were at dinner, and she said, somebody at dinner had just told her about it. She said, "Can I see it and look at it?" And I gave it to her to read, and she went off and rang me 6 weeks later and said, "Look, what I didn't tell you at the time was that I work for a publisher in New York, and I'm taking your book back with me to New York, and I'm sure we will publish it." And that's kind of what happened. So it was a book in every way that was kind of gift after gift.
Yeah. So can I ask you now, David, about your short stories?
Yeah.
And you are predominantly a writer of realist fiction. Not entirely, okay.
Yeah.
Now, you tell me what you want.
No,
I mean, they're realists, but they also have... they have that illusion of lifelikeness, but there are subterranean things, there are dreams, there's satire as well. So I wouldn't call you a straight realist writer, but there tends to be that genre, or that form tends to be, in contemporary culture, a bit disparaged, isn't it, that it's not... So what's valued often is the experimental, the different, the so-called different.
I'm not sure that I know what realist writing is, really, because I would say that most of my books they don't have plots.
No.
On the whole, there's very, very little plot. They mostly are put together rather like a poem, because they're put together by association rather than logically following one from the other. I would have said they're mostly something that I would... No, I think it's a probably more unpopular word than realist. I think they're poetic in that they're almost always about an inner life rather than a world of action. And even if it's a world of action, it's often something very like symbolic action.
Mm-hmm.
So they're put together in a dreamlike, I would say. You know, the way in which there's a logic in dreams, they're put together like that. And I don't say that I ever thought this is the kind of fiction I'm going to write. I just find that each time I've tried to fashion a work of fiction, it's usually been like that, whether it's Flyaway Peter or Ransom or so I wouldn't think that realism was
I don't mean realism in the kind of, you know, Patrick White's version of dun coloured journalistic prose. I don't mean it in that sense. I mean that you create a world in your stories, as well as in your novels, that the reader believes in, the reader believes to be true. So it's not that they're not artificed, it's not that... And there is, in your short stories particularly, there's that beautiful sense of composition, of shape, of texture, of colour, as you would find in a poem. But what I mean by that was that you, even in a short story, you immerse yourself in the world that you believe to be true, and unlike some modes of experimental fiction, your attention is not drawn to the fact that what you're reading is a work of fiction. So they're not... But that's what I meant, that they're not kind of artificed in that way. But does that make sense? Okay. Right, let's move on.
I'm quite interested. See, I don't think readers make those distinctions, and I don't think writers make those distinctions either. I think the reader will go anywhere that the writer takes them, and what induces the reader to do that is something I talked about briefly last night in relation to a question, and that is something else which I think is very mysterious and can't be learned, and you can't know whether you have it or not, and that is something that has to do with, from the very, very first word, casting a kind of spell on the reader that is the real source of the reader's trust in you and in the work. And in some ways, it's the real source of the reader's satisfaction. It's what makes the reader believe that reading the book, they are writing the book. How you do that, I don't know. I couldn't teach anyone to do that. I couldn't ever be certain that I could bring it off. But each time, that's what you hope is going to happen.
I have an academic background, so that's probably my problem.
Oh, that's some of I. I'm not putting academics down when I say that. I mean that an academic can have a certain kind of frame of mind in which you want to name categories, but readers really don't give a stuff about categories.
So when you read, this is getting right off the topic, but it's about reading. When I read fiction, I read it in a double sense. So I read it both critically, analytically, and I'm conscious of what writers are doing in terms of craft and technique. But if it's a good book, I also simultaneously immerse myself in the emotional experience. So I always have this, in a good book, I always have that double sense. You're thinking, my God, this is well written and this is why. But I'm also totally caught up in the spell of the book. Is that the same experience for you when you're reading, or do you let those critical faculties... No, you don't do that.
I taught for a very long time. I taught school, and then I taught for 10 years at Sydney University. And when I was teaching at the university, an awful lot of my reading was determined for me by what I had to teach.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, every Christmas would come and I'd think, okay, I sit down now and read Portrait of a Lady again, because I know I'm going to teach that in first year. And in doing that, you bring to the reading a certain kind of set of attitudes and questions, like, what do I think of Portrait of a Lady this time? It is different from the way I read it last year. You think about questions of teaching it. You think, gosh, look what he's done. I didn't realise he was doing it in quite that way. And I worried. And then I read a few other things. And then I worried when I finished teaching. I gave up teaching and went off to Italy. I decided I was going to find out what kind of writer I was. I had to get right away from everywhere where I had people looking over my shoulder, like here, and telling me what I could do. So I took myself off to a small village in Italy and locked myself up there for 10 months every year for the next 8 years. And I said to myself, I wonder if I can get back to reading the way I read when I was a kid, or the way I read when I was even a student, which is a different way from the way I was reading as a teacher and a university teacher. And I could. I just read and read stuff and reread stuff with that kind of thing, like, just let it all happen. This is all experience. I don't have to ask myself questions about what the dumbest person in my first year tute will make of this. But it came back.
Yeah.
And there is a kind of reading of that kind that we have when we're very young, and we can get it back.
Yeah.
So it is different.
Yeah.
I found it different.
Yeah. Yeah. That leads me to... actually grew out of something you said last night in your opening address too, about, no, it's a better part, it was something I read in the Australian, article in the Australian, where you talked about the rise in popularity of non-fiction and of fiction that's based on kind of information or research. Do you want to talk about that?
Oh, look, I find that both in fiction these days and especially in film, that most of the films I see these days, they're not utterly free pieces of invention like those wonderful screwball comedies, which are my absolutely favourite films. They're all based usually on some real event. They're about revealing tensions, you know, which are in the society, dealing with divisions in the society and all the rest of it, and which means that they're not free. The events that are going to happen in the film are not free. They're not going to surprise you in a certain kind of way, the way films once did or the way novels did. Or they're not like novels where what happens in the novel really derives from the energy, usually, of a single character, you know, who changes everything. Characters in the book are all agents of something else, you know, which is larger than them, which means that they don't have a kind of they don't have autonomous energy. And I find that mostly disappointing. And, you know, it's very easy for us to look at books like Balzac, for example, you know, extraordinary Balzac, or even Victor Hugo, the Hunchback of Notre Dame, or Les Miserables, and say, we see that as somehow naive, because those characters are being taken as being people with real power. Jane Eyre, Wuthering Heights. We don't really want, we find it very, very hard to write fiction these days. Where the characters have that kind of autonomy. They're usually the victims of circumstance, and circumstance is what the books are usually about. And I find that narrow and...